Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. On this programme, the last of 2015, we hear from Charlie Holmes. He's a former music producer, now lives in Tuscany, Siena, in fact, in northern Italy. He'll be talking about Licio Gelli, who's died just this week, aged 96. Licio Gelli was a fascist who cooperated with the CIA at the end of the Second World War, and he was also the master of P2 Lodge. He was actually running the whole of Italy from his two apartments in Rome as part of a political far-right scandal, including the kidnapping and death of the former Prime Minister, Aldo Moro. He was also in charge of Operation Gladio, when NATO were killing ordinary Italians and blaming it on communists. The whole plot really being to keep the communists out of power. We also hear from Scott Bennett, former Army psychological warfare officer, on ISIS and rebels in Syria financing through UBS Swiss Bank. But first, Charlie Holmes.
We've had press reports here about the death of Licio Gelli, and most of them couched in the idea of, oh, he's a man of mystery. This seems to me to be just there to obscure some of the facts which are known about his fascist allegiances and his role in, particularly in Operation Gladio, on the members of the public, the police, etc. in Italy. The whole point really being to blame these attacks on the left wing, on the Red Brigades, etc., and to really bounce Italy into being a puppet state of America. So could you just in your own words, Charlie, give us an idea of who Licio Gelli really was? Because he quite clearly wasn't just a man of mystery, which is what they're trying to tell us here in the press, and, oh, now he's dead, all the mysteries have disappeared too.
Well, I mean, confirmed Licio dead, Gelli died the day before yesterday, about 11 o'clock. He was 96 years old. He had quite a good innings. There's no denial or any trying to deny that he's a fascist. They even had the fascist labels on his tour. He made a public statement a while back saying he was born a fascist and he'll die. So there's no secret about that. The fact that you say he was the mystery, that's also here. They use that the same here. They repeat that kind of thing. Oh, the mysteries. Whereas a lot of these mysteries are almost now common knowledge. I mean, he's involved in a lot of things. Gelli, the story from the Second World War, when he was obviously an asset of the OSS before the CIA, and he was then a fascist. So the CIA basically had a network of fascists working for him, or the OSS, as they were then. And he was one of them. He then, after the war, they picked him up again when they first started off with their... was it the National Security Council, their first document that they were going to intervene in Italy. Shortly after that, they sent a guy over, I think he was called Frank Giolitti or something like that, Giolitti, and he came up and they wanted to reorganise the Italian Freemasonry. He got Gelli on the case and they got the P2 up and running, or P2 as they say in Italian, as in English, and he was basically their man, yeah.
So what was this propaganda duo? What was it? Just if you could just use, propaganda, introduce it, and I'll just say, well, what is P2? Can you just explain it from the word go?
Well, it's a lodge. Originally, it was a lodge.
Can you just, sorry, Charlie, but can you just say, propaganda duo is a Masonic lodge or whatever, and start like that?
Yeah, okay, well, Propaganda Due was founded, I think, in the late 19th century, early 20th century, around 1900 or something like that. And it was specially founded for people in public life. So it already existed long before Gelli came along. But he was then given this role to take over this lodge, which had existed for 60-odd years, and get lots more public people involved, basically. And he got, officially, the list is 1,000. Which is what they found, but the real list was probably more like 2,000, and they were all public body, basically anybody who was anybody in the army, the arm forces, all the politicians, all top lawyers, anyone who was top of the game was on in P2.
Well, they obviously weren't all, because like not Masons, but you've got two problems here, haven't you? First of all, you've got, since lots and lots of powerful people are secretly networking around the P2 Masonic Lodge, it's obvious that if people want to progress in public life, they're going to have to join the Masons. That's almost taken as read. But the problem is that with all the secrecy involved with Freemasonry, a lot of people would say, and I would add my name to that, that this is not compatible with public office. So can you just expand those two points a little bit?
Well, as far as I know, Italy was united by British and French Freemasonry. So, I mean, Italy is kind of founded by Freemasons, as was America. But, I mean, Italy is definitely seriously Masonic. This area, Tuscany, is like total. I mean, they can totally control this area. And I think they totally control this country.
How do you know that? Because it's a secret society, Charlie.
Well, yeah, it's a secret society, but, you know, there's, you know, I think people talk about it. You know, there are ways. I mean, the Grand Master of the Grand Order of Italy is Stefano Bisi. He is the director of the newspaper, which is 20 miles down the road from me, and 29 miles from Arezzo, where Licio Gelli lived. So, I mean, if you start putting pins in the map, you know, there are a lot of Masonic things going on here, basically.
Whereabouts do you think you'll find, these are populated by what professions mainly, and P2 particularly?
Well, P2 was everything. I mean, the lists are published on the internet from years there. But you're talking about generals in the Carabinieri, in the finance police, in lots of politicians, ministers, secret service. I mean, everybody, like I said, anybody's anybody if you want, you know, people in power, judges, lawyers, barristers.
But hasn't your guy Ferdinando Imposimato, the retired chief of the Supreme Court, actually come out dead against all this, dead against Bilderberg, against P2, and against Gelli? I mean, as far as I understand, he was one of the most senior judges in Italy, and he's actually published a book, about the unpunished massacres. He said that these people have been killing people, but they've got away with impunity.
Power, basically. Nobody had been turned over. I mean, they've never been they're there, they died, and or whatever, they're still going. But I mean, Fernandino Imposto's book is a very good book, but there are lots of other books like that. I mean, he's not the only person who's written about that. People have been writing books about the strategy of tension and the years of lead, as they call them, in Italy, for years. I mean, now there's a lot of books written about it. His book was good, because obviously if your source is a top judge, then I would have thought that, you know, who is going to be better than that? And yeah, his book does cover the Banca Ambrosiana, which Gelli obviously was involved in, which is where Roberto Calvi ended up under Black Friars Bridge with a rope around his neck. That took the British police about 10 years to decide he was murdered. I mean, before they said it was suicide for a long time.
Well, the interesting thing about that was it's actually a ritual murder, wasn't it? Because, he was dangling under the bridge, and when the tide comes up, it reached his feet, you know. So this is actually a Masonic oath that they swear in the lodges, that if you reveal the secrets of the Freemasons or cross the master of the lodge, that you're going to end up like this. And of course, he did end up exactly like that. But tell us, Charlie, many people will remember the news story about the guy found, the banker found under the Black Friars Bridge, but who was he, and what was behind that?
All pretty much. I mean, David Yallop wrote a good book about that in the 80s. I mean, that was a whole mixture of things there, with the Banco Ambrosiano, which was a bank which worked for the Vatican and with the Mafia and all sorts of other people, and Gelli, of course. I mean, the thing brought the money to buy the Exocets, which sank the British warships in the Falklands Wars. Gelli sold those to the Argentine. And you think he borrowed the money from the Banco Ambrosiano. It might have been why Calvi ended up with his neck in a noose on the Black Fritz, also a very significant name in the story.
Okay, also the Mafia. I mean, it does sound a little bit like the Mafia, doesn't it? Is there any real known links between P2 and the Mafia? Are they both the same thing, or, you know, what's the link, if there is any?
Well, basically, the Mafia have got a lot of money, and the reports are that the Freemasons are the link between the Mafia and the institution. So the Mafia have got a lot of money, they want to launder it, and normally the Masons, you know, get on with laundering it. So if you look at it like that, basically, I mean, anyone who's got a lot of money, they launder most of their money in London. So, I mean, you want to ask people there about it. You know, if someone's got a lot of money they want to launder, I mean, you're welcome, aren't you? Come in, sir, please, Mr. Mafioso. So, yeah, I mean, the link is that. The Mafia is doing illicit business, and Jelly is dealing with all sorts of illicit businesses. So, I mean, they've got things in common, and they need each other. Calvi needed Jelly for certain. Jelly needed Calvi, and so it goes on. I mean, the actual workings of it are written in quite a few books of actually how and what they were doing. But they're basically money laundering and stealing money from depositors or creditors or whatever you want to call them. So, I mean, that's their common link, basically.
Okay. Yeah. What about the specifics of Jelly? Let's just go back to, you know, this question about he's the man of mystery. He's being put across as a man of mystery, not talked about here in Britain as a fascist. But, well, I mean, if you could pin down just one or two things that he's known to have been involved in, and to paint, you know, his character as to who he really was, Charlie, what would you point out?
Well, the fact that he worked for Gladio, and he set up the...
Sorry, can you just say Jelly? Sorry, if you just start by using his name.
Okay, yeah. So, well, the fact that Jelly worked for the overseas A or NATO or whoever it was actually who set up Gladio, I think that's quite significant, because that obviously that bombings of Bologna station and things like that, he actually was found guilty of involvement in that. I think dipistaggio, they said it, and it was like, you know, hiding evidence or shielding people. He was involved behind the scenes with, how do you say, corrupting the course of justice or something like that. Situation. He got 8 years, but he didn't actually go to prison. He was in house arrest there. Obviously the P2 is a big one. When they discovered that was a big story. I think they're the main things, really, the American Secret Services and NATO with Gladio, well, I would say was probably the biggest thing. But then, like, the boss of Italy, I mean, he controlled everything. He was like, they call him the puppet master, and he really was, because he had so many people, and so many people come to see him. Fernando Imposimato's book describes how Jelly had two apartments in the Excelsior Hotel in Via Veneto, really downtown central Rome, right next to the American Embassy. And in the area, there were just about everybody. The right-wing terrorists even had an office down the road in Via Sicily. And so Jelly, really, you know, he almost was like it was like a coup, really. Jelly.
I mean, you talk a bit about 1945. What was the role of the fascists at the end of the Second World War? Because I know the Americans were rolling up, most of the Americans anyway, rolling up through Italy in a northerly direction. And I know that there was a lot of friendships built up at that time between those American Secret Service people behind those troops and the fascists that remained at the end of the war. So what was going on there?
Americans already had a network with the right wing people, because they were also monarchists, and then you have a traditional right in Italy anyway. So I mean, you have to sort of distinguish between exactly who were fascists and who then became monarchists or traditional right wing people. Obviously, all the aristocrats and all the people with land and all that were quite down with Mussolini. There was no problem. People that weren't so happy with him were, you know, the communist type people, so who were obviously banned. So I think really the Americans were already thinking about the post-war, because because there is a document called War and Peace, which was written by the Club Foreign Relations. In fact, Ferdinando Imposimata talks about it, and it was like a kind of the occult version of the Marshall Plan, which was already quite tough. So they had this kind of plan already as what they were going to do. I mean, like Patton wanted to go straight through into Russia, didn't he? So when the Italians came up, when they wanted to sort of be communist, left wing or whatever, they wanted the workers getting power back. The Americans were totally against that, of course. So they were more siding with the wing and the fascists, if you want to still call them fascists, because once Mussolini had gone, they weren't fascists anymore. And I think that's basically the size of it. The Americans had already decided whose side they were on. And it wasn't the people that were actually supposedly fighting on their side. The partisans were all obviously left-wing. And I don't think the Americans were really too keen on them at all.
Well, they probably, Churchill will probably say the same. I mean, it just fascinates me, Charlie, to hear you talking about the way Jelly was in Rome. Can you just paint a picture of that in comparison to what it was being rolled out at the time in the newspapers about how Italy was being run and who by?
Strategy of tension, and these bombings were going on. They were going on at the same time. There was the famous play by Dario Fo, the accidental death of an anarchist at the time, which was this guy Pinelli, who they arrested and were giving him a pretty hard time. I mean, we obviously don't know what exactly they were doing to him, but he evidently jumped out of a window. I mean, it's a bit of a sort of a bit of a joke, a bit of a sick joke, obviously, on him. But they were actually setting up these anarchists or left-wing type people at the same time as they were training the right-wing terrorists. NATO were training them, sending them to Germany and places for training. There was a campaign to set up the other people. And this guy had no money at all. He drove to Rome from Rome with his Cinquecento, his 500 lire, and he needed to borrow 500 lira to get there. And he got there, and when he got there, they arrested him for something, for one of these bombings. Whereas it was right-wing terrorists who were very well-off, rich people, sort of thing, from well-to-do families, and who were, everyone else. So then, of course, if you look at the political people who were in power at the time, Andreotti and people like that, basically, there were one or two others, but they were all pretty dodgy. So, I mean, yeah, Jelly was obviously very dodgy, but around him there were also a lot of other dodgy people who the Americans wanted to keep in power. They didn't want these. The death of was the same thing. Aldo Moro wanted to do a deal with the communists, and they said no, we're not having that. So they murdered him, and then figured out the Red Brigade, if the Red Brigade were actually even not working for them anyway.
This strategy of tension, these days of lead. Can you just describe, what that actually means to Italians, and then maybe compare it to what's going on in Europe? I mean, we've had complete lockdown, haven't we, in Brussels, where now apparently anybody that questions government in France is considered some sort of terrorist suspect. So it seems like there may be parallels between what the strategy of tension, the days of lead in Italy back in the 1970s and 80s, and what's happening right now today.
Well, yeah, the strategy of tension is something that is limited only to that period. It's a strategy which they roll it out when they want to, and I think at the moment it's obviously going rather well.
Okay, well, just describe what it was then in a nutshell. What was actually going on? How did it work in Italy?
Well, I mean, there were roadblocks everywhere with carabinieri with machine guns, which they still are now, but I mean, lots of cops kind of thing in the road, and you're driving down the road and all of a sudden there's 20 or 30 cops with machine guns checking everybody out. I was here in the 70s when the students were shot in a demonstration in Rome. I was in Rome, not far away from the demonstration. I wasn't then. We went, and then there was lots of panic and people screaming and everything, and what's happened there? They shot some girl, and or whatever. So yeah, I mean, it was battles on the street between people and the police, and they would be raiding people's houses and all that. I mean, I think there were sort of cells of people in Italy who were actually doing little, putting bombs in dustbins and things like that, or little kind of I got the idea of that. The people that I'd met were sort of like up to something. There were things going on around the place. But the real terrorists were obviously the Gladio operation and people like that. So the real killing, the bombs that killed a lot of people were probably right-wing fascists, if you want to call them that. And they were linked to the government. Linked to Jelly and to the P2 and everything like that.
Okay, so what would you make about what's going on in Europe now, what with the Paris attacks and the lockdown for nearly a week in Brussels, this kind of thing?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not an expert on terrorism. I think that it's very difficult for people to actually carry out these attacks without having some kind of help from intelligence agents. That's my personal opinion, but I mean, I don't know, so I wouldn't really want to comment on much. But they say, oh, this guy was known to the police, and this guy, they kind of know about these people, and then all of a sudden they pop up and kill, massacre people. I mean, it's pretty terrible. I mean, obviously people living close by are terrified, so I mean it's kind of working, but I think it's something that they let happen, basically, and it suits them. Then they got an excuse to bomb Syria or do whatever they want to do. That's my personal opinion, but I mean, as I say, I don't know.
What brought an end to the strategy of tension in Italy? Did it end around about mid 1980s? I think it sort of everything kind of calmed down a bit, didn't it?
Yeah, I don't know. Italy is a bit of a strange country. I mean, it's a country where, it's a bit theatrical and, the whole thing is lots of, the political parties are like different tastes of ice cream and everyone's, happy to get dressed up and eating. And it's very difficult to actually know the truth about anything. I mean, most of the major scandals in Italy end up where you just don't know. I mean, the monster of Florence. I mean, it's just a nightmare of you have to go right back to the beginning and then just chuck away everything and start again, basically. And most of the big scandals in Italy end up like that. So you never really know until someone like him comes out and writes a book. Then you can say, well, he's a judge and, he went back over his old investigations with Moro and all that and made some quite interesting statements. I mean, all the documents had disappeared and he had to get a friend of his to get them out of the Senate. I wouldn't sort of really trust anybody.
So just tell us a little bit about, try and do it in a nutshell if you can, but a bit about who this Impossimato guy was, is, and, some of the main things he's talked about in his book about the unpunished massacres.
Fernandino Imposimato's book, The Unpunished Tragedies, or whatever you want to call them, the atrocities, it's very good because, I mean, he's very thorough and he writes. I mean, he does get a bit, heavy going. But, I mean, he's very good for the detail and he gives a really good biographical study of, where he gets his information from, his sources. So that's very interesting. It gives a lot of information about what it was sort of 1947. So therefore, the involvement with the mafia. There's this bandito Giuliano killed a lot of people at a May Day festival, and then the Americans said he was great. They liked him. He, just got his gun out and shot a lot of people who were, celebrating May Day, basically sort of communisty type people. And as I say, the Americans thought that was good. That's what they need to do. So, and then there was these brothers of Sicily, the Friends of Sicily. They were like, they wanted Sicily to become part of America.
Well, that sounds like almost like a euphemism for the mafia, the Friends of Sicily.
Well, they were, because, they sort of linked up with all these kind of the offer and all that, all these real sort of dodgy mafia guys. They were all kind of involved in this thing, so you can see the links between the mob in it, as they call them in America, the Sicilian mafia, and they use them. I mean, they're part of the machinery. Lucky Luciano helped them during the war to land, and there's lots of collaboration between the mafia and the intelligence agencies. So yeah, I mean, you've got like he gives a good cross-reference the whole story from say the war up until the times when the bombs were going off in the 80s and then on from there, and so I think it's a good complete book if you want to read about the the troubles in Italy. Obviously, the book's not been, it's not allowed to get translated into English, a book like that. But I wish somebody would translate it. It would be good. But that is definitely a book that tells you about the whole sphere. You know, what's going on. And he talks a lot about the bombings and the operation behind it, because he went and he had to go in interview, you know, interrogate some of these people. Changed his mind from at the time. He said he thought, you know, one way, that these people were complete idiots, and then they what they were telling him. And then years later, he found out that it was true. So he had a kind of a change of heart about the whole thing when he later on. And it's a very interesting book.
Okay, Charlie.
Charlie Holmes, yeah, from Tuscany, yeah. The old worm man. But I'm just I'm into permaculture, Tony. Lombri compost. I breed worms, and I do that kind of stuff. Yeah, I was in the music business, but now I'm not. I haven't got any money. It's music producer, management, or whatever. But,
music producer turned permaculturist. How's that?
Yeah, that's what I do. I breed worms, and I'm big on it. I'm really, it's going good.
That was former music producer Charlie Holmes. He's now doing permaculture from his home in Tuscany, in northern Italy, near Siena.
Whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop, that's the sound of the police. That's the sound of the beast. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the police. Whoop, whoop. That's the sound of the beast. Stand clear, done, man. I talk. You can't stand where I stand. You can't walk where I walk. Watch out, we run New York. Policeman come, we bust him off the park. I know this for a fact. You don't like how I act. Selling crap, will you be doing that? I'd rather say see ya, cause I would never be ya. Be your officer, your wicked overseer. Your hot shot, you wanna get props and be a savior. First show a little respect, change your behavior. Change your attitude, change your plan. There could never really be justice or stolen land. Are you really for peace and equality? Or when my car's hooked up, you know you wanna follow me. Your laws are minimal. That's
We hear now from Scott Bennett. Scott Bennett used to work for US CENTCOM, that's Central Command, in Florida. That's the US Army's office for overseeing and running the wars in the Middle East. Hardly ever talked about it, of course, in the mainstream press. Scott Bennett, as part of his work, discovered that UBS in Switzerland was being used as a terror financing conduit. He reported this to the British Embassy and also to his bosses and was promptly fired from his job, even though he was an officer in the US Army. As part of his psychological warfare work, he was doing all sorts of interesting things, but no, he's now an independent researcher and he's got a lot of interesting things to say about how ISIS are getting their money.
Scott, this whole business with Syria, we've been really pulling it apart here in the UK, particularly with the British now vote in the House of Commons to join the US bombing of Syria involved in ISIS. And amazingly enough, not even one of the MPs really talked in any serious way about the probability, almost the necessity, that by bombing, it's going to be an incredible recruitment tool for ISIS, and there'll be a lot of people who are incensed at the injustice of this and then looking to take up arms against the evildoers, the perpetrators, you know, from Iraq, etc., etc. I just wondered, what, you know, your expertise in all this is to do with the terror financing, and I just wondered if you could give us a basic assessment of how vulnerable ISIS is to having funds cut off by the West. I'm talking about Swiss banks, Western banking, big conglomerates, HSBC, the regulators, governments, that sort of thing.
Well, the ISIS funding has predominantly come from Swiss bank accounts that have funneled money into charities from Gulf nations and Saudi Arabians and Qatar and people like that. The royal families have donated money through their accounts that have gotten into, you know, the hands of the fighters. And that's come through charities, some come through the Five Pillars of Islam and things like that.
To what extent is that deliberate, Scott? Or is that money that has been somehow conned from the Saudi royals? To what extent is that deliberate? Or is it money that's been conned from the hands of the Saudi royal family?
Oh, no, it's absolutely positively deliberate. That's the Wahhabist ideology, is to advance the strain of their takfir, conquer the world in the name of Islam ideology. It's a perversion of true Islam. It's a perversion of the tolerant ideology that the more moderate believers have. It's, you know, in the Christian ranks, you could compare it to those who go and bomb abortion clinics and kill people in the name of, you know, their Christian belief, are not representative of the majority of the Christian people who don't do that. But the Wahhabist ideology is geared towards violent subjugation of people and conversion or enslavement. So the royal family, the Saudis, a lot of the Gulf nation persons, but in particular the Saudis, have deep embedded financial holdings on Fox News, for example, Georgetown University, George Washington University. A lot of their instructors are at U.S. Central Command, instructing military theory and thought on, religion. They leave out the particular characteristics of Wahhabism. You have to sort of find that out on your own by being on the ground or doing alternative studies. But the truth is, the Shia, the Alawite, the Yazidi sections of Islam are far different than the Sunni Salafist, Takfiri, Wahhabist ideology. And that's the differential that the West really doesn't understand. But the money is coming down from these Gulf nations through Swiss banks into the hands of the fighters on the ground. And the U.S. has been complicit in funneling that money and protecting that money and protecting the oil smuggling that's been going on between Turkey and Syria. And it's only because Russia and President Putin has stepped in, drawn attention to this aspect, exposed them in the G20 summit, exposed the smuggling lines and the truck lines of oil smuggling and destroyed them, when the U.S. for the last year has let them go free and clear without any destruction.
Okay, so, Scott, tell us about what you discovered about the Swiss role in this, because we really hear almost nothing about Switzerland's role in actually helping to create, not necessarily create, but certainly to maintain a kind of financial supply line. As we know, anyone that's anything to do with the military knows, supplies are absolutely key to enabling an army to continue to fight. Otherwise, it just dies on the front line. And quite clearly, supplies nowadays take the form and resources of cash, money, by whatever means. What did you discover?
Well, the Swiss banks are up to their neck in terrorist financing, money laundering, drug laundering operations. And they're also up to their neck and hip connected to the American government and the Obama administration.
Can you name specific banks?
Well, there's the Union Bank of Switzerland is the biggest one, and HSBC and Credit Suisse as the main Swiss banks that I came across. But Union Bank of Switzerland was the one that I focused on in my counterterrorism terrorist finance report that was sent up to General James Mattis, who was in charge of Central Command, and Martin Dempsey and Ray Odierno and the House and Senate Armed Services Committee and Intelligence Committees, none of whom did anything about it. No one in the U.S. government did a single thing about the reports that we submitted. And in fact, they threw the whistleblower, Brad Birkenfeld, in prison when he brought all this material up.
Well, that's pretty frustrating. But, I mean, tell us exactly what you were finding in those banks. You know, is it? Well, probably can't name specific bank accounts, but what were you actually managing? Where was the money coming from and to? And, you know, specifically, what did you find going on within those banks?
Well, I will name a lot of this is still being brought into the courts, and it hasn't been classified, so I can't talk about it. I never talk about things that are classified. But what I was given by the whistleblower himself, for example, was the bank accounts of Saudi Arabian wealthy royal family and other people, one of whom was Abdullah Aziz. And I won't say too much about him, and I won't say the bank accounts because of the bad guys who are listening to this, and I'm not going to give them free intelligence. But Abdullah Aziz was one of the key contributors to the terrorist operations in the Middle East. And he was a Saudi, and he was connected with Rudy Giuliani and the Oil for Food program that had existed prior. There was also the Osama bin Laden connection to Union Bank of Switzerland, and his brother being a UBS account holder. It throws into question any of the claims of the bin Laden intelligence files and computers that were acquired.
As part of your intelligence reports, did you also submit a sort of profile of Abdulaziz? Because he obviously sounds like quite an interesting guy we need to know about.
Well, yeah, he's I won't go too much in, but I did finalize and submit his bank account information from UBS that Brad Birkenfeld had given to me, the actual documents that had the account numbers and the money that he had and the donations and the charities that he gave to, and how this was getting into the hands of bad guys on the field. And not one person in the U.S. government or the U.S. military ever debriefed myself or Brad Birkenfeld about those accounts. That's where treason has occurred, because everyone who's lost a son or daughter in these wars could have had their son and daughter given back to them. They may not have lost a leg or arm had these bank accounts been stopped, frozen, or the money tracked to the original donors. It's only because of President Putin stepping up and drawing attention in the G20 is a lot of this stuff now coming out. And you see the U.S. scrambling to get ahead of it, scrambling to give the impression that they've been on the side of right all along, where the opposite is true. They've been on the side of the ISIS, Al-Qaeda type mercenaries since 2012. When our report was originally submitted, the general of the DIA, General Flynn, received a copy of our report, and he never did anything about it, except there was a DIA cable that was released that talked about we realize the Gulf nations are creating ISIS as a mercenary force to destabilize the Shia in Iraq and Syria. Now, my particular finding was that Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer at the Department of Justice under the Obama administration worked for the same law firm Covington and Burling that represented these terrorist finance bank accounts. And Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer protected those banks by throwing Brad Birkenfeld in prison when he brought all of this material up originally. Now, the other connection was a gentleman named Roger Zackheim, who was the son of my boss, Dove Zackheim, who was the comptroller at the Pentagon, who lost $2.3 trillion at the Pentagon, and then left the Pentagon to work at Booz Allen Hamilton and manage its terrorist financing operations. Well, Dove Zackheim's son, Roger Zackheim, worked at the House Armed Services Committee when I submitted my reports. Now, those reports I submitted were buried, were destroyed, were not given to the higher-ups in Congress by Roger Zackheim. He then left the House Armed Services Committee in December of 2014, or 2013, I'm sorry, and went to work for the same law firm, Covington and Burling. So this is a very important connection to see, is that Roger Zackheim, Eric Holder, Lanny Brewer work for the law firm that protects these Swiss banks that are being used by the Saudis and the Gulf nations to funnel money to the ISIS combatants.
For anyone,
Hillary Clinton
has
also gotten money from Union Bank of Switzerland.
Just say that again. Sorry, that final bit there.
Hillary Clinton got money from the Union Bank of Switzerland, and Hillary Clinton coordinated the prosecution of Brad Birkenfeld in 2009. So Hillary Clinton was paid by Union Bank of Switzerland to cover up all of the whistleblowing that Brad Birkenfeld brought.
Now, it's amazing.
And that's corruption of the highest levels of the U.S. government.
Yep, I think we've got it here too, I'm afraid. It's awful to say, but the kind of lawlessness really going on, particularly in the city of London, all sorts of money laundering, terrorist financing now seems to be okay, and a kind of a system of impunity. But look, you just mentioned there CENTCOM, didn't you? And I know there's also these AFRICOM. For many of us, certainly most of our listeners would never heard of CENTCOM. We don't get talked about, it doesn't get talked about on the news here. Neither does AFRICOM. But these play quite an important strategic role, Scott, don't they? I wonder if you could give us an idea of what are these commands? Is it U.S. Central Command, U.S. African Command?
Well, I worked at U.S. CENTCOM, which was U.S. Central Command. It's in charge of all of the Middle East war operations. I worked in the Joint Interagency Group, which was all of the agencies of the United States government working on tracking money supplies of terrorists. So I worked with CIA, State Department, FBI, Homeland Security, the Department of Treasury, all of the intelligence sectors and all the government agencies who were designed to track down terrorist finance. That's why I know Brad Birkenfeld and his 19,000 bank accounts were the gold standard of intelligence that we should have been given, but we were denied. We were denied by Eric Holder and Lanny Brewer and President Obama and Hillary Clinton. So all of that intelligence came to me quite accidentally. And when I got it, let me tell you this, Tony, I sent it also to the British Embassy in Washington, D.C. I sent it to the British because it was unclassified, and I knew British soldiers and British contractors were being killed or wounded in the 9/11 wars because all of this money was flowing unstopped and unchecked by these Swiss banks into the hands of the bad guys on the battlefield.
I mean, what would
and
be
the
effect?
British never did anything about it either.
What would be the effect of turning this money supply off if someone could actually start feeling some collars, arresting some of the Swiss involved in this money laundering and terror financing?
Well, you would immediately dry up their sources for buying bullets and bombs and roadside bombs. You would drain up their ability to lavish new recruits with thousands of dollars. You would dry up their incentives for doing all sorts of propaganda campaigns and bribing and paying people to join the jihad. I mean, right now, the U.S. has been funding and providing the first aid kits and the uniforms and the Toyota trucks and all of the weaponry. And it's asinine to claim that the U.S. accidentally dropped them out of the back of C-130s and they floated down to the ISIS positions and the Iraqi army just picked up and ran away like frightened dogs and the ISIS just happened to stumble upon it. That's nonsense. That's a lie. That insults the intelligence of any reasonable person. Of course we plan the dropping of this material and the money supply into the hands of ISIS, because our agenda has been to use ISIS to destabilize Assad and to remove him. Regime change, as you know, Tony, has been the modus operandi from the Bush administration and now through the Obama administration. And that modus operandi of regime change has been a black flag, charred black soil campaign that's left Libya destroyed and in ruins and in an absolute chaotic state that's come close to destroying Egypt, that was able to pull itself out. Iraq is stumbling and falling, and the Shia have sort of come in to support it, and Iran has supported it. But now we're looking at gaming Syria and destroying Syria. And Russia will not tolerate it, because if Syria goes, then they will invade and destabilize the southern border of Russia. So Russia has stepped in. And what's interesting is, by Russia stepping in and Turkey being put on the defensive, suddenly we're seeing all of the previous refugees that were coming through Turkey into Europe suddenly becoming slowed down, if not stopped. So Russia is appearing to be the savior of Europe. Russia is stepping in and stopping the refugee flow, stopping the illegal oil and financing of terrorism, and rising up, you know, like a phoenix out of the ashes.
Well, hang on a minute, because what they're doing is leaving many of these refugees to have to stay to try and scrabble out a living in the Middle East, where there's bombs flying this, that way and everywhere.
They don't even have a civilization left, Tony. They don't have buildings. They don't have running water. They don't have electricity, because the United States has bombed them into oblivion and allowed the Saudis and the Gulf nations to bomb them out of oblivion. It's only now, with Russia stepping in, giving air support to the Syrian army, that they're able to push these ISIS Takfiri types back. Now the question is the European NATO coalition going to try and reverse those advances that Russia has made? Is NATO, France, Germany, and Britain so suicidal that they're going to go in and try and start a war with Russia and get on the wrong side, which is the Gulf nation, Saudi, Qatari, Kuwaiti side, which have been feeding this instability, this agenda to try and make it a Sunni Takfiri caliphate. By the evidence, the American people and the British people, as you know, Tony, they do not want war. They do not want their governments aligning with ISIS. They don't want their governments giving aiding and food and comfort and medical supplies to savages that rape and behead women and children. But for some odd reason, the British elite and the American elite want exactly that. John McCain, Lindsey Graham, Cameron, all of these people are putting up a good front that they are fighting the ISIS, ISIL savage components. But they're talking out of one side of their mouth and doing the opposite.
Well, one of the main reasons that they're giving for this is these terrorist attacks, things like San Bernardino, the Paris attacks, Scott. I wonder what's your assessment as a former army officer about the who is actually carrying out these attacks? Because there certainly does seem to be some questions about who is actually responsible for them. I mean, problems with identifying specific Muslim individuals at the scene at the time in both of those different attacks, and also a whole history through NATO's Operation Gladio of carrying out false flag attacks as such. So what's your thoughts about those two specific attacks, and maybe others if you wish, as to the case that David Cameron and others, Hollande across Europe, are using, that they need to get involved in Syria in the matter of self-defense because they're under attack by ISIS?
Well, there's a long history of false flag attacks in this country. And when you look at the USS Liberty, for example, the naval ship that was attacked by the Israelis in 1968, I think it was, as an attempt to bring the US into the Israeli-Egyptian war, which failed. That was an event where the Israeli fighter jets intentionally attacked and tried to sink and destroy an American signal ship. And it was later discovered the Israelis planned it. They knew all along it was a United States ship. And John McCain's father, as you sent me before, Tony, a lot of very good intelligence on this, tried to bury the investigation. And then you have the false flag attacks of, you know, the U.S. government military leaders trying to say they wanted to shoot down airplanes full of students and blame it on the Cuban government. And then flash forward, of course, to the 9/11 attacks on the Twin Towers and the Pentagon as being the trigger point for these 9/11 wars.
But hang on a minute, Scott, when you were actually serving Army officer, were you questioning things like these 9/11 attacks?
I wasn't, to be completely honest with you. At the time, I saw some things, and I saw the footage of the missile of the, well, they said it was a plane hitting the Pentagon that's later been shown to be a missile. I remember in rooms with military officers and leaders asking, do you think this was real? Do you think it was something else? And I remember senior military officers going, no way, that was real. That was a plane. I don't believe for a second it was a missile. These people who are on the side of conspiracies are all crazy. And I thought, you know, well, I don't know. And it wasn't until much later when I did the homework and I started being educated that I came to the reality. I woke up out of the dream. I stopped drinking the Kool-Aid, that the official story was impossible. And that the real story was this whole thing was a false flag to generate a neoconservative empire building agenda to destabilize the Middle East, dominate its resources, with the next stage being to destabilize Russia and China. So there are definitely false flag accusations. The most recent ones that you've just drawn attention to, I've done some very interesting shows with Jim Fetzer and some other researchers. Kevin Barrett is another good one. And they've basically provided a lot of very convincing evidence that the San Bernardino shooting was not perpetrated by a Muslim woman and a Muslim man, but in fact was done by three white males and, you know, possibly contractors for Kraft International, which is a mercenary company, which was also present in the Boston Marathon bombing attack. That San Bernardino is still coming together, but the evidence is very profound. The evidence of the bodies and the blood not being bodies and not being real blood, because red blood turns brown, not bright red, and a lot of other questionable examinations of the car and the glass and the body itself, and then the time. Now, the parachutings is another one. We just did a Islamophobia conference on what is the psychological operation component of this? Why are black flags occurring? And as you know, Tony, it's to generate population control, to dominate population, to scare the population into surrendering a lot of their rights, to surrender their right to walk freely on the sidewalk after 7 o'clock at night. Now they're under martial law. Now they can't step outside. Now it's impossible to speak. You know, in France, they have a law. You can't talk about conspiracy theories, or conspiracy theories are illegal, which is basically saying any questioning of a government narrative is now becoming illegal. I mean, it's almost Nazi Germany reinvented, but far, far worse. Because now you've got a dumbed down population, panicking and fearful, and government agents or contractors orchestrating these flamboyant artificial attacks. And unfortunately, we're not there, so we can't see if there were bodies. We can't see the blood. We can't see the spatterings on the wall. We can't look at the bullet. We have to take what the media is showing. But the internet, I think, is solving a lot of these intelligence problems, because the internet allows people, everybody, to become a detective and everybody to submit photographs and timelines and maps, where you can map out and measure the distance between the shooting and the police and federal agency offices to determine if they were there before. Rather than if it was like a 2-hour journey between the federal office and the crime scene, how did they get there within 5 or 10 minutes? Well, it's because they were there ahead of time. Well, why were they there ahead of time? Because they had a drill. Well, why did they have a drill, shooting drill, on the same exact day that this shooting supposedly occurred? So suddenly you begin to see a lot of very suspicious information and things.
Okay, and Scott, where do you think this is all headed? Because we're actually now engaged in the Syria conflict. Britain and America and other NATO countries flying around in the same country are very much active, all bristling with air-to-air missile Russian jets now too. I mean, this is a potential hotspot. We've also got another one. It's not a potential hotspot. It is a hotspot. And we've got another one in eastern Ukraine, in the Donetsk region and Crimea. Yeah. It seems that there's actually quite a lot of crossover now between some of the NATO forces, particularly obviously in Syria, not necessarily Ukraine, although there's a lot of military advisors and apparently in training going on between Western armed forces and the Ukrainian, some of them the far right, the Pravi sector, the right sector fascist groups in Ukraine. But whereabouts is, what's your crystal ball prediction as to where this is heading? Because we've got two major problems. Let's forget the climate crisis for a minute, but we've got two major problems. We've got Russian classic NATO confrontation with Russia, as well as hanging over everyone's heads is the potential of crash financial crisis with an enormous, probably the biggest ever property bubble. So that's where asset prices and the stock market prices have been artificially pumped high for many years now through quantitative easing, printing money, and the real economy is starting to stall. We've got a reduction in consumption of oil because of the lack of activity in the real economy, and the beginner to see a big slump in oil prices as well. So where are we heading, do you think, through and after Christmas with all this?
Well, in a quick summary, I had an intelligence person contact me and said Friday things were going to get dicey. So make sure you've got some money taken out and protected, because Friday may be the incident on the day when they pull something. I know I was in touch with the French intelligence last March about the Swiss banks and financing, and the French intelligence officer who contacted me never debriefed me, never asked for additional information. So the French were fully aware of the Swiss bank connection of the terrorism. So that's a fact that hasn't gotten out. How this is going to go forth in the future, I think you're going to have the NATO, British, U.S. Strike Russia in the Syrian area. They're going to pull a false flag gas attack or some major event that's going to legitimize and justify a U.S.-NATO intervention and attack against Russian forces. And that's going to be designed to try and get all of NATO and the U.S. and Europe into finishing the destabilization of Assad.
But Scott, hang on a minute, because the Russians have made it absolutely clear they're not going to allow that to happen. They've got their base, their very important naval base, Tartus, in the eastern Mediterranean on the Syrian coast. The Russians know if they lose that, they lose their influence in the region, which they've been hanging on to for really since the Napoleonic era.
That's
the Russians have been hanging on to.
And
they're not going to allow
that. I know that, and the Russians know that.
So the Russians
the
are not going to allow.
They don't know that.
Really?
They think the Russians are bluffing.
Well, the Russians have made it absolutely clear, Putin has this week, that he's ready for war if they want it, effectively.
And see, they think he's going to back down. They think he's not serious. He doesn't want to risk. I think there's a delusion and an arrogance that has infected the Western mind where they really are divorced from reality. The Russians aren't like that. They're a very rustic sort of knuckle-dragging, raw mentality in a lot of respects. And I like them very much. But the U.S. and the Western NATO, European, they think they're the epitome of civilization. They think they're the climax of humanity, and therefore they need to sophisticate these barbarian Russian hordes.
Okay, so who would win in such a conflict? Because, I mean, we know, don't we, that both sides have got a particular problem these days, and that is that
Russia would win.
Okay,
Russia
but there's a lot of high-tech military stuff out there, some of which has not actually been proven in battle conditions, and but specifically at this level, high level, with superpower versus superpower. So yeah, who would win, and how would you see that sort of war playing out?
Well, Russia would win because of the geography and the distance it has in the Syrian area of operations. With Iran there and Syria there and China there, they would win because China would do some maneuvers that would demand U.S. attention in the Pacific. and Russia would do simultaneous maneuvers in the Mediterranean, which would weaken the resolve of the American people to get into a two-front battle. The European people, I think, are increasingly going to be communicated to by the Russians, saying, we represent European values, not the Americans. We represent European stability, not the Americans. The Americans have been destabilizing all these Northern African, Middle East peoples. They've been running them up through Turkey, into Germany, into Sweden, into Britain to destabilize and infect those countries. The indigenous population of Europe, I think, is now standing up saying, you know what, we care about women and children who are legitimate refugees from a war-torn country. We care about them, but we do not want thousands of young men just simply moving to Europe for a better life. That we're not an open immigration country. And that's what, especially when you start having a clash of cultures that may react and result in violence or smuggling or sex trafficking or any sorts of other abuses, that's sort of a tinderbox waiting to go. Because this is European culture. And I think it's going to cause a retribalization. I think you're going to go back to the pre-Schengen European nation-state identity, where people are going to go back and reassert that they are Scottish, or they are German, or they are Swedish, or they are Norwegian, or they are whatever their peculiar country history is. They are going to preserve that European heritage.
Okay. What about the other side of this? What about the other side of this, Scott? And that is, I mean, I know you're not necessarily an expert, although you were looking a lot at terror financing, but we're in a situation where we could have an almighty crash, much bigger than 2008, and it wouldn't be any kind of bailout, any kind of consideration of that either. The banks would not be bailed out. You know, you'd end up with a financial system that was basically broken. Everyone's savings disappeared, this kind of thing. I wonder what you make of how that might play out, a crash. And also, obviously, if there is some sort of military trigger in the Middle East, that crash could happen any time.
Well, right. The military trigger and the economic collapse would, I think, you see the beginning of it in the civil martial law establishing in France. It would be replicated in the other countries of Europe. And they would try and do it as a European Union army thing. I don't think that would hold water. I think the European countries and their people are very close to a civil war in their own country, in their own political leadership, with regards to Brussels and the representation or lack of representation of their country in the EU Brussels establishment. I think there's going to be an impulse where people are going to retract out of the EU. You know that the British have a certain differential from the continental Europeans. The Scandinavians have a different cultural heritage viewpoint. So all of the countries of Europe are separate and distinct with their own personalities and culture and history. And I think that's what they're going to cleave to if you have an economic collapse and a military strike. You very well could have a quiet civil war in Europe that you already see that sort of writing on the wall when you see European leaders from the Eastern post-Soviet bloc saying, we need a Europe of strong individual states, strong individual sovereign states. They're saying we are not one big massive European landmass. We are not the United States of Europe.
Yeah, but the trouble is, Scott, they're weak. Most European states are weak. And over many years, much of the state assets, look at Greece. I mean, that's a really extreme example. But many other European countries are similar. Portugal, too, where their state assets have been pretty much stripped off and privatized. There's not a lot left. How can they be strong if these states are now so fragile?
Well, they're not. See, that's where we very quickly could come to the point of an economic collapse monetary-wise, where the money is very similar to Germany at the 1930 level, where they had massive inflation and their money became worthless. I think you very easily could have a similar situation, and the people are stripped of their money value, and what do they have left? Well, they have their heritage, they have their family, they have their roots and their land. You could have a massive readjustment, not even to bring in the petrodollar abandonment and the BRICS nations having an alternative economic foundation and an alternative economic life, something that is a substitute for the International Monetary Fund, something that's a substitute for the World Bank.
Well, of course, the Russians and the Chinese have started
to driven against is the point of these Middle Eastern wars is because Libya and Syria, for example, were not playing ball with the Western economic model. They were not going to go along that way. And the U.S. took them out. Europe took them out. Tony Blair took them out. So it's a war of civilizations based on the financial system.
Just go back, Scott, for a second to talk about the military side, because, of course, these are nuclear powers that could come to blows in Syria, aren't they?
Yes.
Do you think that there would be any possibility of nuclear weapons actually being used? Because we are told, aren't we, the fact that nuclear weapons have been around since the 1940s has actually kept the peace. Well, what happens when the peace is broken? Well, I wonder what your assessment is of that.
Well, I don't think anyone would use a nuclear weapon because Israel is so close. They don't want to destroy themselves or their people, so they wouldn't set off a false flag nuclear act because they'd be hurting their own people and country. I don't think Russia would because they're close to the proximity. So would the U.S. use a nuclear event to trigger a heightening and increase in their war? They could, but I think it's doubtful because, again, the U.S.-Israeli partnership in these operations is too close. They can't affect a nuclear release of some degree. Now they could release something in Europe. They could try and release something up in Chechnya and blame it on the Muslims. I don't think they're that sophisticated. I don't think the Muslims would do that. I don't think ISIS is intellectually or technically able to do that. The only people that could would be the U.S. or Israel. I don't think Russia would do that, but I think we're seeing an alignment of these different poles of power. We've got Russia, China, Iran, that has increasingly Brazil and India and South Africa coming alongside the Russian system, because ideologically and philosophically, Russia and Putin has been able to articulate a vision of stability and order that is based on countries working out their own destinies without interference from external forces. That's what China believes. They believe in allowing countries to develop and not being meddled with from the outside in. The U.S. believes absolutely the opposite, and it's because of that belief we've got the wreckage and the trauma and the destruction of the nation states for the past 20 years that we have. I think Europe is seeing the fruit of that by these thousands and thousands of people boarding the train, coming up into Germany and bleeding out like a hemorrhage of blood that just now you've got guys sitting on the street corner smoking, not working, can't speak German. They're just occupying a position and they're getting paid on the German welfare system. And that's happening in all these different states in Europe. And I think they're rising up now against it. They're saying no more. We can't afford these people. We don't want these people. This is European culture, European heritage. People could come here on very strict, controlled levels. We don't just open up the floodgates and let them in. Okay, so what about adjustment's coming?
Yeah. What about can you see any kind of hope in the end of all this, Scott? I mean, if you were actually sitting in the White House, you were actually up in the Pentagon, able to sort of direct things yourself. Are there particular parts of the U.S. military, NATO military, that you think should be, closed down or actually being very counterproductive, very dangerous today? If you were a military commander, you were one of the policy makers sitting in the White House in Washington, what would you be doing?
Well, if I was in charge of the military in Europe, one, I would say do what we were asked to do by Europe in the beginning, which is defend the European borders from invading armies. And this invading army is one from the Middle East and these ravaged countries. But as suffering as they may be, we have to control this. We have to protect Europe. And I would immediately pull out of the Syrian Assad fight and let the Russians win it and win it their way, I would eject Turkey from the European connection. And I think, as I've said before, I think a military coup d'etat against Erdogan is going to come because he's such a criminal element, and his son being exposed as a criminal who is engaged in the oil smuggling that the Russians have just exposed. I think a coup d'etat is coming, in which it would be very healthy for Turkey to establish itself as sort of the Switzerland of the Middle East. It's not loyal to the U.S. It's not loyal to Europe. It's not loyal to Russia. It's sort of the middle ground. With regards to the U.S. political theater, I look at all the political candidates for who is coming up to replace Obama. I think Obama is a puppet. I think he's hell-bent on sort of destroying the reputation of the United States. And the only good thing he has done is sort of the agreement with Iran, the nuclear agreement. I think that's what we should have done. We should allow them to determine their own destiny. But I think when I look at all the political candidates that are coming up behind him, I look at Marco Rubio, and I think he's far too young, and he's too reckless, and he's too militaristic against Russia. And I think that's based on some of his religious antagonisms against the Russian Orthodox Church, being Rubio's a staunch Roman Catholic. Jeb Bush has a similar Roman Catholic denunciation of the Russian Orthodox, and Jeb Bush was also tied with a lot of CIA financing operations.
You know what?
In
it sounds to
America.
Me like almost you've got a similar thing going on between the Shia and the Sunnis in the Middle East going on right now in the presidential race. I mean, you know, actually the Roman Catholics and the Eastern Orthodox Church is much, much closer than even than the Protestants are to them. So the whole thing sounds a bit confected to me. But look, just to wind up, Scott, is there any light at the end of the tunnel here?
Well, you know, I would hope that Donald Trump would be the only person who could be educated by good advisors to do some smart policies. He does have the foundation.
But the guy's got the support of the neo-Nazis, for goodness sake, and the Ku Klux Klan. How are you going to educate him? I mean, is he really the best hope?
Well, he's of all the other candidates I see out there, I do like Rand Paul, but I do like Trump, and we'll see how they evolve. I'm interested in smart people and smart policies. And yes, he's wrong on a lot of policies. Trump is wrong on a lot of his warmongering positions. But he's right when he says Russia I could get along with, and Russia should be allowed to destroy ISIS and we should not. Now, he's also wrong in a lot of other things, but we have to look at who do we have up there that is going to be elected. Now, I hope he becomes smarter. I hope he changes his policies on a lot of levels. War is not the answer. War has caused us to be absolutely destroyed, and he seems to get that. Him and Rand Paul seem to be the only voices up there. Kasich isn't too bad, but they seem to be the only voices that are starting to discuss, hey, we should never have attacked Iraq in the first place. We should never have gone into Libya, and we should not be in Syria. We should not be looking to the rest of the world to manipulate and control them. We've destroyed our reputation with Europe, and where do we go from here? Do we continue down this hegemony empire building war mode, or do we come back, recalibrate ourselves, get back to our own original constitution and founding fathers, and be friends with Russia and try and be friends with Iran, and stop fighting the Israeli wars that we're being pushed into by the neoconservatives and the hardcore, Zionist element that looks at every neighbor of Israel as an enemy the U.S. needs to fight. I don't think the American people want that. I don't think Europe wants that. I don't think the Russian people want that. So it's getting rid of a lot of the elite agendas that have been put in place since September 11, 2001, replacing those, exposing them with truth, and trying to get a new crop of new political leaders to stand up and be a lot more isolationist. Yes, you can have free trade and free economic partnerships, but in one sense, you need to stop these interventionist military operations. That's what's angered the entire Muslim world, and it's not going to do us any good.
Former psychological warfare officer Scott Bennett there, and you can find him on Twitter at Army PsyOp, PSYOP. With army in front of it. So that's ARMY PSYOP.
OP on Twitter. You can also find him online. Just do a search for Scott Bennett. That was the last Dialect for 2015, so wishing you a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Also, as well as all that, a Happy Yule, Happy Winter Solstice, and we'll see you in 2016. We'll be back in the first week of January 2016. I'm Tony Gosling, and this is Dialect. You can find us online at dialectradio.co.uk, and we hope to be back soon onto Bristol Community Radio.